This is the Professional Hypnotherapist Podcast, session number 008. Fiona Coyle, Chief Executive Officer, Mental Health Reform. Fiona brings to mental health reform her many years' vast experience, from community development in Ireland to international development in the United Nations and women's rights in the European Union. Fiona's commitment and dedication and her advocacy for human rights and mental health reform is second to none. Listen as Fiona educates and informs us on mental health reform. All of this and more on today's edition of the Professional Hypnotherapist Podcast. Welcome to the Professional Hypnotherapist Podcast, a production of the European Association of Professional Hypnotherapists. That's EAPH.ie. To Fiona Coyle, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Mental Health Reform in Ireland. Thank you for being here today, Fiona.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, Fiona, mental health is very much in the media. You know, we're hearing about it in both printed media and visual media, and rightly so too. So how important, to ask a question, how important is our mental health?
I think our mental health is fundamentally important. And, you know, I think that the pandemic has really opened up a conversation. You know, it was often for generations here in Ireland seen as maybe something quite separate, you know, something quite individual, I suppose, to the person. And discussions on mental health difficulties often focused on individual factors, and, you know, rarely was it discussed that, you know, the circumstances which people are born or live can affect, you know, our mental health. And I think the pandemic has made people realize of, you know, everyone has mental health and that it can be impacted, you know, by external factors. So it's really great to see it having such prominence in public discourse at the moment, and rightly so, as you said, because, you know, we to say the saying, there is no health without mental health. You know, you have to look at the whole being, both physical and mental health, and, you know, they are equivalent to each other in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Now, you're the CEO of Mental Health Reform. Now, do you yourself have a background in health or indeed in mental health?
My own background, I'm actually a community development worker by training. So I've been working, you know, originally working with kind of communities affected by drugs in Dublin. And then I moved to work in international development and in human rights. So I worked with the UN for a number of years, working in a country called Lesotho, working on human rights and gender projects. Yeah, and I worked for our Irish Aid, which is Ireland's overseas aid program, and been working on kind of very much kind of with human rights. And the last number of years, I joined Mental Health Reform in 2020. And before that, I worked in Brussels for 4 years, working specifically on women's rights. So, yeah, Mental Health Reform, you know, we're the National Coalition for Mental Health in Ireland. So we're an umbrella body consisting of over 77 member organisations. And we very much, you know, take that human rights perspective. So it's been really brilliant to take my experience of working in different countries and different contexts back here to Ireland, because there's so much, you know, that can still be done. Like, people have a right to health. People have a right to mental health services. And in Ireland currently, you know, our legislation is out of sync with international human rights standards. Our services are kind of underinvested in, and you know, people have long waiting lists that they're facing. So it's been really interesting to kind of take some of that experience I've garnered over the years and look at it in the context of working towards better mental health services for individuals around the country.
Excellent. Well, you preempted all of my questions. Anyway, now you mentioned, you know, in terms of that, you're a coalition of 77 different member organizations. And also on your website, you mentioned that, I'm reading here, that the government is serious about its new mental health policy that's sharing the vision and wants to make those recommendations a reality. Investment is needed.
Yeah, like high quality services need high quality investment. You know, there's no other way around it. You know, you need that investment. And for years, it's generally agreed that there has been underinvestment in our services in this country. It hasn't been prioritized politically. And you know, COVID has really exposed some of the gaps in the system. People would say that before COVID we had a mental health crisis, and you know, what we're facing into is, you know, perhaps increasing demands for a number of years to come. So you know, we really need that investment. There's a lot of talk, there's a lot of support for mental health, but unless that's translated into actions and into money, you know, new money on budget day, you know, services can't grow and can't develop without new money.
Yeah, indeed. And why do you think, you know, you mentioned that there's lots of talk and lots of, you know, talking about it. But why do you think mental health, you know, is way down on the pecking order?
Yeah, I think I suppose if you kind of take a bit of a historical perspective of mental health in this country, like in the 1960s, we had more people in mental health institutions than anywhere else in the world. I think the figure 1 in 4 you come across very often.
That's interesting. And, yeah.
And that's not that long ago.
No.
And we started to transition, you know, like the UK and like other countries away from that model, you know, really kind of going towards like a more community model into the 80s and then the 90s. And that led to the launch of what was then seen as a really important document, Vision for Change, the mental health policy, that really was moving away from institutions and led to the closure of a number of institutions across the country. But the vision was that you would move away from institution but build up those community mental health services. Uh-huh. And, you know, it was brilliant, a really brilliant document. But then Ireland went into an economic crisis and mental health wasn't prioritised. And the changes that were to be invested in and were to be brought forward, it never quite happened. And we're still struggling from then to now to really start building, you know, those services. I think, you know, there's obviously challenges that are faced, you know, within the services in relation to recruitment of staff. That's a challenge for, you know, for the health service more broadly. But I think that's led us to where we are today. You know, unfortunately, you know, that policy was launched at a moment in time when the country was just on the verge of a crisis, and you know, the funding, instead of increasing, actually got cut across the board, and we're still recovering from that period.
Yeah. Do you think, Fiona, that there's still that stigma about our mental health?
Most definitely. And you know, I think sometimes, you know, in Ireland, we might pat ourselves on the back a bit too soon and say it's brilliant, more people are talking about mental health, we've got celebrities speaking out, you know, we've all these campaigns. But when you speak to people, especially people who have maybe more severe and enduring mental health difficulties, the stigma and discrimination that they face, it's still very real, you know. And I think, you know, like I mentioned, the 1960s, like, that's my parents' generation, and the stigma of that time of having a family member in an institution was huge. And, you know, people weren't institutionalized. Like, the evidence shows they weren't, you know, institutionalized for mental health difficulties alone. You know, some people perhaps, you know, they were gay or lesbian, or, you know, some people for just being poor, you know, they were put in institutions. So that stigma, that takes time to move away from that. And, you know, that's kind of 60, 70 years, we're moving in the right direction. But, you know, we still need to demystify a lot of things, you know, around some of the kind of difficulties and some of those who have more severe and enduring mental health difficulties, that people are comfortable with it. You know, so much of our knowledge comes from movies or TV programs where, you know, things are sensationalized, and that's not always the way. So we need to open up a more genuine conversation, I think, and be a more accepting country for people with all types of difficulties.
Yeah. And how do we open up that conversation, in your opinion?
I think it's, you know, it's giving more space to people who you know, who have those difficulties, you know, and who have, you know, who've recovered or are on their own recovery journey. Like, there's wonderful initiatives like the Green Ribbon Campaign, which is ongoing currently, has the aim of doing just that, of breaking down the stigma, you know, that the work that Sea Change does throughout the year is really important in that regard. So it's bit by bit, I think. And, you know, a lot of the work that we do as well is, you know, mental health, it's not just the Department of Health, but, you know, it's not just for them. You know, we need a real cross-departmental approach. So it's equally as important, you know, that someone, there's so many people now, you know, who are living with mental health difficulties, who could live independent lives, and, you know, there's no housing for them, or they're not able to get employment because of some of the stigma surrounding their difficulties. So, you know, it's really taking that holistic approach. It's not just about the mental health services. It's allowing people to live their best life, and, you know, like, opening up conversations with employers, like, to demystify, you know, what it's like maybe employing someone with a mental health difficulty, that someone with a mental health difficulty actually feels comfortable saying to their employer, look, you know, I have this, it might mean X and Y, or I might need this type of support, and they don't have a fear that they're just going to get fired, which has been the case, you know, in the past. So there's lots of different ways, and I think it's people, you know, educating themselves as well. You know, what is mental health? Do I actually know what that term means? Or, you know, it's been used so much now that people may not know, you know, what exactly it is, and they may be fearful of asking because they don't want themselves to be judged for kind of asking what they perceive to be, you know, a silly question. So I think it's okay to ask, and it's, you know, it's okay to learn and to be on a journey.
Yes, indeed. And to what extent, you know, does language and labeling, you know, come into the whole scenario? Because you use an expression there, the word difficulty. Now, that in itself can perhaps conjure up in people's minds a what I would refer to maybe a negative connotation. Is there, in your opinion, a different terminology that we could use?
Yeah, no, it's you're very right. Like, words are so powerful, and the language is really powerful. Like as mental health reform, our preferred terminology, we do use mental health difficulties. Now, yes. I suppose other terminology you would hear would be, you know, mental health illness, and we've tried to keep away from that language ourselves. Now, we do say, you know, anyone, you know, it's up to, if someone is living with a mental health difficulty, if they want to call it an illness or difficulties, up to them to determine the language that they're comfortable with. So we'll never, you know, be prescriptive in that regard for what others use. But for us, you know, we're very aware of moving away from medical terminology because of, you know, what kind of, we're trying to move away from a medical model in this country, and using that type of terminology is not appropriate language. But, you know, people react and relate to language very differently, and language, you know, it can act as a barrier to prevent people kind of understanding and then maybe showing empathy or helping others. Like, you know, I'm sure we've all kind of been using terminology like, oh, you know, oh, that's crazy, or that's nuts, or, you know, that's something that's been very common, very colloquial type of language in the English language. But it can stigmatize communities, and it can stigmatize individuals. And I suppose by changing even some of that basic language, you know, we can kind of help understand, open up kind of channels to understand other people's experiences.
Yes, indeed. And sometimes I like to, you know, if you use a metaphor of a boat, a rowing boat, and one oar is your physical health and the other oar is your mental health. And, you know, both of them should be pulling at the same rate so that the boat gets where it wants to go. So that's maybe some way of looking at it in terms of our mental health and our functioning in a holistic manner.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of looking at it. Like, you know, there's a huge intersection between both, and, you know, mental health, it is a continuum as well. You know, you've everything from kind of people now, some people are listening, you know, over the last 18 months may have experienced kind of low level anxiety for the first time, or kind of, you know, low level depression. But then you've kind of got a whole spectrum then towards kind of those more kind of severe and enduring difficulties. So even understanding that, and that it is a spectrum, and that at any one stage we could be anywhere on that, and any of us can move along it. And yeah, it's how it intersects then with their physical well-being is really important.
Now, in terms of mental health reform, you know, you have, I suppose you have a mission and you have a, let's say, a vision. So how do you go about affecting or implementing your mission and vision?
Yeah, so I suppose just what we're trying to do is trying to ensure that, you know, we live in a country where every individual, no matter where they are able to achieve their best possible mental health. So, you know, that's the goal, that's what we're moving towards. And what we do then within that we're, you know, as a coalition, we try and bring together our members and speak with one strong voice, which we all know is so powerful, to drive that reform of our services and our supports. And I suppose on a day-to-day, you know, that all may sound a bit abstract, like on a day-to-day level, what does that look like? So, you know, we do a lot of policy submission. So we try and, you know, change or reform the way that services are set out in policy. So to, you know, not just with the Department of Health, but, you know, we do policy submissions to Department of Justice, of Housing, Employment, you know, just so that mental health is considered. So we bring our members together and use that collective expertise to feed those submissions. We also really put a huge importance on people with lived experience and, you know, their families, friends and carers. So in everything we do, we really try and ensure that we're being reflective of some of their experiences. So we have a grassroots forum, which is comprised of service users and their family, friends, carers and supporters. And a number of years ago, which you may find interesting, we did the first of its kind study in Ireland called My Voice Matters, which looked at the experience of service users in accessing services in this country. So, you know, what are people's experiences? And that was really insightful. And, you know, so much came out of that, like, you know, that people, you know, even when they're in the services, they feel like their voices is perhaps missing, you know, and that's what we're moving towards in this country in our new mental health policy, is services where it's a partnership between the service user and the service provider, you know, because each person's mental health journey is unique. So the services have to cater for each person individually. So that's kind of, we do our own research and then we do a lot of campaigning. So, you know, at the moment, what we're campaigning for is for the government to invest €85 million in additional money in our mental health services in budget 2022 in a few short weeks' time. So we kind of bring our members together and try and make your voice as loud as it can possibly be to ensure that mental health remains on the top of the priority list.
Okay, now and that happened in terms of that you launched your pre-budget campaign on Tuesday the 31st of August, isn't that right?
Yes, we did. We did it outside Leinster House with some of our members and service users. And then we had an event, a virtual event, as all events are these days, where we had, you know, we had people, a wonderful activist called Mary from the West of Ireland, share her experiences. And we had some insights from some of our political allies, if I can call them that. So Senator Francis Back and Deputy Roisin Shorto and Deputy Nessa Horgan as well joined us for that event, which was brilliant. Yeah, it was a great start to our campaign.
Now, you also mentioned on your website the currently, apparently, Ireland is spending 5.1% of the health budget on mental health, and you want that increased to 10%.
Yeah, 10%. It's not just our ask. You know, this is the government's own commitment. Under the Sláinte Care document, they've committed to investing 10% of health budget in mental health. And, you know, like, as I said previously, high quality services demand high quality investment. And, you know, the 10% figure, actually, you know, the WHO, they recommend that mental health spending should be at 12%. In the UK, they spend 13%. In other countries in the Nordics, it's, you know, 13 up to 15%. So our spending, you know, it is very far behind where it should be, in our opinion. And, you know, we'd like the government, you know, we don't expect, you know, the budget to be doubled overnight, but we'd like a plan in place. You know, we'd like that commitment that there's a recognition of, we need to get to X. We've said this is our own recommendation. How are we going to get there? You know, are we going to try incrementally increase our spending year on year?
Okay. Now, that's one of the steps. I think you have 9 pointers there to what do governments need to invest in. And the first one I can read here is that you want a budget increase of 10%. There are also like increasing staff levels across mental health services. Can you just briefly go over those points, if you don't mind?
Yeah, no problem. So, like, I suppose our mental health services, predominantly, you know, there are staff-based services, and staffing, you know, across the country, community mental health teams have huge staffing issues. And, you know, we need to have new money to put new staff in place. Now, I will also acknowledge that, you know, this is a difficulty. There is a difficulty in recruiting certain types of staff. But, you know, we need to look kind of creatively at how we can, you know, how can we engage staff across Ireland. Primary care is another huge area of investment. Like currently, you know, people's first port of call most often is to go to their GP to get their advice, and the GP will put someone on a waiting list for maybe primary care psychology. There's over 10,000 people on that waiting list currently. Majority are children, and half of those, more than half, have been waiting for more than 12 months to be seen. So, you know, that's really important that we're investing in that primary care. You know, then we hear so often in the media, you know, talk about our child and adolescent mental health services. CAMHS is the acronym you might hear. Mm-hmm. Again, long waiting lists, you know, for children. So they need to be invested in. The community and voluntary sector, like over the last 18 months, you know, many of our members moved their services online overnight, you know, going from face-to-face to virtual, like developing new types of services. And the last year, you know, there was additional support there, but we're moving into a period now, like there's no going back. You know, the previous model of delivery, there's no going back because we've learned so much. We've started to dip our toes into e-mental health, into innovation. Mm. But, you know, that's costly. It costs money for community and voluntary organisations to develop new services. And they've also been reporting, our members have been reporting, an increase in demand for their services. So we believe, you know, we're calling for money to be invested to support the community and voluntary sector. And then we have other asks kind of specific to different areas. So advocacy services, we've been calling for years. Like often it can be a very difficult and very lonely journey someone navigating our mental health services. And, you know, in other countries, we've seen an independent advocacy service can really help people. So someone who's on your side who can help you navigate the services. So that's something we've been calling for a number of years, but there doesn't seem to be an appetite there at the moment to set up such a service, but could just really transform, you know, I think people's experiences. Then, you know, investing in kind of affordable housing, in employment supports, and also in terms of, you know, in really scaling up the mental health services and for those who are in the prison system. There are so many individuals at the moment who are in prisons who shouldn't be there. You know, they need different type of support and they're not getting it. So, you know, there's a lot there that can be done with the 65 million. We're calling it's 20 million to maintain the services as they are today. You know, costs go up, things happen. You know, it could cost 20 million to run today's service next year is what we believe. And then the additional 65 million, you know, that's a lot. You know, can achieve such a lot with that money, as you just heard.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned there about the prison population, because I don't have the statistic, but I'm sure quite a large percentage of people in prison, that they have a mental health issue, no doubt.
Yeah, like I think I don't have the statistics in front of me either, but yeah, I do know, like in terms of the prison system, it does disproportionately, I suppose have a disproportionate number of people living with mental health difficulties in the prisons. And, you know, like what we've been calling for and what some of our members have been calling for is that, you know, they need to be diverted at the earliest possible, you know, with their first you know, the various possible juncture, they need to be diverted away from the justice system into the health system. And you can, you know, we know that that's not happening because, you know, the amount, the pressure that is on the central mental hospital at the moment, you know, there is, you know, a new hospital just opened in Portrane, but already we're hearing from those who work in that system that there are, you know, there are like not enough beds. And I think one of our members, the IPRT, the Irish Penal Reform Trust, found that the lowest number, this is in July 2019 to July 2020, the waiting list from prisons into the central mental hospital, the lowest number was 20 service users waiting to be transferred in, and the highest was 33. So that's really high. 20 people who are in a prison who are really, you know, when you go into that central mental hospital, you have, you know, severe difficulties and you need specialized support. And the fact that those 20 individuals were in an environment which would be, I think, severely distressing for them, but also for their families and communities to think that someone isn't getting the support that they need. But yeah, this is something, again, for years that we've been highlighting that there hasn't been a huge amount of change on. And I suppose, you know, unfortunately, when you talk about the prison community, it's not a topic that gets maybe the gets into public discourse as much as it should. But people's rights are being violated.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what comes into my mind is that as therapists, and specifically hypnotherapists, you know, we would deal with clients who are not having their needs met. And it's when you're not having your needs met, something goes awry within ourselves, and perhaps it's a mental health issue that happens or something else. So that's my take on it. And what's your take on that in terms of having our needs met?
Yeah, like I think that's exactly it. It's this kind of, you know, how the external factors that are so important in all of our lives, that, you know, if our needs are not met, and if needs are not being met by the very system that's there to meet them, you know, that's a huge challenge. And that's something, you know, needs to be prioritized in this country. And there's an opportunity now to do so because there's so much discussion on mental health. You know, I think before there wasn't an understanding of its importance. Well, now, you know, you speak to people and they're like, yeah, mental health, it's so important. So it's there's a moment here to capitalize on. So I think, you know, it's quite positive in that regard. It's one of the, if I can even dare to say, one of maybe the more positive aspects of what we've gone through is, you know, the realization of the importance of mental health, of all of us at an individual level investing in it, and then at a societal level prioritizing it.
Yes. And you touched on it earlier with regard to, you know, the voluntary sector and the huge value that volunteers give in various different aspects of Irish life, but specifically, for example, Samaritans, Pieta House, and volunteers who do the work there. And, you know, I often think that if you were to monetize that work, it would be worth actually millions.
Yeah, like I think Ireland has always really rightly prided itself on, you know, its community spirit. And certainly, you know, over the last 18 months, that did not disappoint. You know, we lived up to it. Like you've seen such wonderful stories of, you know, people delivering medicine or food to neighbours. And, you know, so many of our member organisations are so dependent on the work of volunteers. And yeah, like the Samaritans in particular, like, you know, the work that they do, you know, we launched our campaign in Waterford with the kind of the Samaritans in that region. And, you know, they've answered more than 560,000 calls last year. You know, that's such a significant number of calls. You know, all of our members, like, they provide such valuable support across the country, and, you know, really needs to be commended. But, you know, also I think they're doing such a wonderful job. Like, we can't over rely, you know, the Samaritans should not be, you know, the public services should be there equally, yeah, to assist individuals. Yeah. You know, it shouldn't be an either or, like, they shouldn't be filling that gap. We need to ensure the public system, you know, the work of the Samaritans is so important and so complementary to that. But, you know, we do need to ensure that that the public system is strengthened so people get the support that they need at the right time.
Yeah, that's an excellent point in terms of that we shouldn't really be relying on, you know, the volunteering sector for, let's say, an absence of or inaction on the part of the government.
Yeah, that's exactly it, yeah.
Now, and maybe just to recap a little bit, I noticed the statistic there for CAMHS. There's over 2,700 children on a waiting list.
Yeah. And that's, you know, if you can think about it, that each, it's sometimes when you hear numbers, you forget that behind each of that number is a child who has a family, who goes to school more than likely, you know, who lives in a community, and, you know, the impact that has, that the person isn't getting the support, it impacts all of that ecosystem. But yeah, it's one of the big challenges in this country for, you know, last number of years, and continues to, I suppose, to be a blot on the jotter of successive governments, that they haven't quite managed to invest in that area and to get those waiting lists down.
Okay, Fiona, now going forward, what's the route forward in your opinion?
I think there's, you know, there's huge, to be positive about it, there's huge opportunity there. I think, you know, this is a top issue in this country at the moment. Like, you know, I think RT Primetime did a survey asking people, you know, what are their top areas of concern, the New Normal survey, I believe it was called, and mental health came in fourth, while it never appeared previously in any of those surveys. So there's a moment, but what we need investment. So we need the government to, you know, invest in budget 2022. But money alone, you know, we need to be realistic. Money, the investment is crucially important, but we also need the leadership behind that, both political leadership, but also one of the things we've been calling on is for a senior director level position within the HSE, reporting in our health service executive, reporting directly into Paul Reid, who's the CEO, or whoever that CEO may be, who can move forward some of those structural barriers that are there, who can drive forward the reform. And, you know, that would speak to HSE, who's taking mental health, giving mental health the same parity of esteem as it does to physical health. So, you know, I think we need both of those levers at the same time, the investment and the leadership. We have a wonderful policy. We have, you know, a public supportive of prioritising this issue, and we, you know, we have an opportunity, once maybe in a lifetime opportunity, to change the system for both, you know, this generation and generations to come.
Excellent. Okay, Fiona, so how can anyone out there who's interested in getting involved in mental health reform or mental health per se, what in your opinion do they need to do?
Yeah, great question. And I suppose if anyone out there is kind of maybe nodding along to some of what I'm saying and wants to get involved and support our work, every voice matters. You know, we need to continue to remind, you know, the political leadership in this country that this matters. So please go on to our website, mentalhealthreform.ie. You know, follow us on social media. Make your voice heard. You know, on our website, you know, there's an easy kind of call to action that you can share on your social media, or there's an easy way for you to contact your TD and representatives to let them know that you want mental health to be a priority in budget 2022. So mentalhealthreform.ie, and all the information should be there.
Thank you, Fiona Coyle, CEO of Mental Health Reform. You have been listening to the Professional Hypnotherapist Podcast. Please stop everything and start exploring to find the right solutions for you at eaph.ie. You know you want to make positive, beneficial change in your life, and yet you may not have the know-how. Allow yourself to discover how you too now can start that change process and begin to reap the benefits through ethical hypnotherapy.